I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is filmmaker Marian Marzinski, who has a new documentary appearing this week on Frontline called Never Forget to Lie. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's the Sunday before the least well-known Jewish festival of all, at least major one, Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks, which celebrates the receiving of the Ten Commandments at Sinai and concludes a process of counting the 7 weeks between Passover and this holiday of Shavuos. Shavuot is also called Chag HaBikurim, the holiday of the first fruits, falling as it does in late spring when the very first crops of the summer begin to ripen in hot climates, you know, like Israel. But more about that later. The odd thing is that we'll celebrate this major festival that most Jews don't even really remember. And that's a shame, because in truth, Shavuot, which begins Tuesday night, continues Wednesday, is an important holiday on the Jewish calendar. It was on Shavuot that, according to Jewish tradition, the greatest human interaction with God in all history took place. At this time of year, about 3,200 years ago, we received the Ten Commandments in dramatic fashion. According to the book of Exodus, the commandments were given with lightning, thunder, and smoke, with fire and an earthquake and blasts of the shofar ringing out in the desert air. And out of all that tumult, God's voice clearly conveyed the great message of morality that includes the Ten Commandments. Without the holiday of Shavuot, which begins Tuesday night, we don't have the Torah. And without the Torah, of course, we don't have Judaism. And if we don't have Judaism, we would never have had Christianity or Islam or Western civilization, for that matter. So Shavuot, or as many Jews call it, Shavuos, matters a lot. When celebrating a holiday with this much importance, especially a profoundly unappreciated festival like Shavuot, it's important to think about what we really believe happened. That is, what occurred at Mount Sinai. But before we tackle that complicated question, let's have a little play-in on the subject of Mount Sinai from the great vocal ensemble, the Boston Camerata, a little song to Moses, Mi al Har Chorev, literally, who on Mount Sinai spoke to God face to face. That was Mi al Har Chorev for the holiday of Shavuot, Shavuos, this coming Tuesday night and Wednesday. When we celebrate Shavuot, the major historical theological event we commemorate is the Theophany at Sinai, receiving the Ten Commandments. A key question for Jews, one of the things that shapes whether you're Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox, is just what you think took place that fateful day. For Orthodox Jews, God directly gave us the Ten Commandments and the rest of the Torah and the rest of the Hebrew Bible and even in theory, the whole oral Torah, the Talmud. For conservative Jews, Sinai represents the revelation of at least the Ten Commandments, God speaking to us directly by some means. For most Reform Jews, it was God's presence and connection that were conveyed, or perhaps the Ten Commandments came to us somehow or other. For atheists, the whole thing was the collective, simultaneous imagination of about 2 million people. I guess I vote for the belief that something amazing did happen at Mount Sinai, something so powerful, wonderful, and potent that it has remained in its content and memory at the heart of all Western religion ever since. I doubt that God recited the Ten Commandments aloud to everyone. Even some Midrashim, ancient rabbinic commentaries, believe that only the first two commandments were actually given to all the people aloud. And I certainly don't believe that the whole Torah was given at Sinai, and absolutely not the whole Talmud with it, as Orthodox Jews do. But as a Reform Jew, and of course a Reform rabbi, I do believe that something tremendous and profound was conveyed, that at Mount Sinai we experienced God as we never had, and never have again since. And so, as we celebrate that experience on Shavuot, Tuesday night and Wednesday again, with prayer and celebration, it's a good time to think about what we really believe about our own tradition, how we might best understand the true meaning of Torah in our lives. To more extensively play us in on this late spring morning, it has been a glorious week here in the Sonoran Desert where I live, by the way. May it not get really hot till July. We have a lovely musical arrangement of a song of thanks to God, Ode L'Eli, recorded by the Yale a cappella group, Magevet. That was the song Ode L'Eli, I Give Thanks to God, first recorded by the late Ofra Chaza, but sung here by the Yale a cappella group Magevet. When we come back on Too Jewish this morning, we'll meet our guest, the outstanding documentary filmmaker Marian Marzinski, whose new movie, Never Forget to Lie, coming out this week, is about child survivors of the Holocaust returning to the Warsaw Ghetto. It's a moving and powerful film on Frontline. Find out all about it when we come back on Too Jewish.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Click difference at Jim Click Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all new body style. It looks absolutely great. And it's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now at bid price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics. academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Marian Marzinski. He is a remarkable documentary filmmaker who has made films not only about the Holocaust, but primarily so. He has a new film coming out on Frontline this week called Never Forget to Lie. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Hello, hello.
So this is a very powerful film. I had a chance to see it before it airs this week. In which you bring survivors of the Holocaust who were child survivors back sort of to the location. Tell us a little bit about how this project evolved.
It's by learning that there will be a gathering of children survivors of the Holocaust in Warsaw, something that this organization did not consider for more than 20 years as being too emotional and too traumatic. And so when I learned that for the first time, probably around 100 of former children from the Warsaw Ghetto will be gathering in a Marriott hotel 5 minutes from the Warsaw Ghetto, I thought that was the greatest casting call that you could ever imagine. You know, I would never be able to bring those people there. And so I got interested and started to correspond with some of them, and then had some list of some dozen of them, and at the end in the film you have, including me, six of them.
How many told you, no, this is too much to go back?
It's actually, nobody says it's too much to go because I was their guide. You know, when we are afraid of something, but there is somebody that tells, come on, I'll bring you there. Then everybody goes, because the curiosity was enormous and the interest. The most frustrating things about the Warsaw Ghetto is that even if people try to venture there, there is nothing there because 95% or more of the building are destroyed. A new part of the city has been built on the ruins, which were actually elevated by 5 feet because it was too complicated to remove them. So when people go there and try to orient themselves, despite the fact there are some plaques, there are some elements of, the configuration of street, people are frustrated, emotional, frustrated, and then they leave right away. So you need a guide, but in this case it's more than a guide because you have a fellow child survivor that is actually bringing them to the courtyard when they were playing, and they don't even know what is about. I mean, what is the courtyard? They didn't think that even exists. In reality, it barely exists, because what you see in the film is the remnants of some 20 buildings, most of them technically condemned, that nobody can go because it's dangerous. And, you know, it takes a film producer and a director to make it possible by, you know, making contacts with janitor, etc. So we almost sneak to those places,
maybe a few coins changed hands too along the way.
That's correct. So, and that was unexpected, not only by them, but also by me when I saw for the first time. That was a shock. I didn't know how deep I can go to the places. And that is basically the secret of the entire film. You probably noticed there's a huge difference when the survivor sits in the chair at his or her apartment and try to, you know, bring images. Right. And when somebody's
standing in the courtyard, we will talk much more with Marian Marzinski in a few minutes when we come back on Two Jewish and hear some of his own personal stories from the Warsaw Ghetto in just a moment. Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Something else to think about as we approach the Jewish festival of Chag HaBikurim, the first fruits festival of Shavuot, when produce was brought to the temple in Jerusalem as an offering. By contrast with us Jews living today, our ancestors brought the first of all they harvested to the temple, gave the best of their produce, and also gave 10% of what they had in addition to that to God. I wonder what percentage we contemporary Jews give to our synagogues now. Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks, which begins Tuesday night, has festival services for Jews all around the world and a late-night study experience called the Tikkun Leil Shavuot. This remarkable holiday, while not as well-known or observed as the other major Jewish festivals, commemorates the greatest act of giving ever. The giving of Torah at Mount Sinai in Moses' time, it is considered the ultimate experience of covenant in all of human history. Publicly at Sinai at this season of Shavuot, we heard and accepted God's revelation. Publicly, we became partners in the great experience of trying to create a moral world. Shavuot is the festival of Matan Toratenu, the giving of Torah, and to celebrate that great gift and to remind us to give from our own gifts, here's a beautiful cantor and choir selection from Chazan Alberto Mizrahi, the Adonai Adonai, from the Torah service for the festival. That was Adonai Adonai, the Shlosh Esrei Midot, the 13 attributes of God chanted for the holiday of Shavuot, the festival of receiving the Torah at Sinai, which begins Tuesday night. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Guy. Good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
You are a very recent father, which raises the whole question of the difference in how American Jews and Israeli Jews are in a very important area called birth rate.
It is. It is a very interesting difference. You know, on average, an Israeli family has 3 children, while the American average family has 1.8 kids. Now, of course, I don't know how the 0.8 works exactly, but those are the statistics.
I always wondered how you had 0.8 children, you know.
Yeah. It's people that do statistics, they figured it out. Anyhow, you know, the other day I had someone from the community come to me and say, oh yeah, you Israelis, you bring a lot of kids because you need them for the army.
Mm.
And I need to honestly say, he totally missed the point. Totally missed the points. Nobody brings kids because they think of the army. People bring kids because they think of happiness. And a few years ago, researchers, mainly in the U.S., claimed that having more kids actually decreases your level of happiness. But recent studies, including the very large happiness study conducted by Gallup and by others, actually proved that actually children increases the level of happiness.
Does that include teenagers?
Well, teenagers might be an exceptional, I agree. But, you know, taking it to the more serious aspect, I believe that the most important thing for true happiness is to have a feeling of meaning in your life. And one of the most direct and harsh ways to ask yourself, do I have true meaning in my life, is to ask a very hard question, to ask, do you have anything that you are willing to give your lives away for? Is there anything you're willing to die for? Most parents, at least the proper parents that you'll talk to, will undoubtedly tell you they're willing to die to protect their kids.
Sure.
And the things that you're willing to die for are the real important things that give meaning to your lives. They're actually the best reasons for you to live. So in Israel, when we have slightly more kids, in my case, 4 children, on average, 3 children, it gives you more meaning. It gives you a sense of fulfillment. It gives you the opportunity to see the world through your children's eyes and to regrow wisdom. I need to honestly say, I can't even remember how life was before I became a father. It's so much part of me those days. It gives you meaning, gives you happiness.
It is stunning. And even when they're teenagers, it gives a sense of purpose to life. I think that's right. That's true whether you're Israeli or American. But still, it is really amazing. 3 kids per family in Israel and less than 2 in America. Very different cultural aspect in 2 countries that are otherwise in some ways very similar. Guy, thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, we began speaking last week about this fascinating question. In the middle of the 18th century, the Jews of Europe found a way to pressure a very capable empress, Maria Theresa of the Habsburg Empire, to not expel the Jews of Prague, not, you know, to do this terrible thing and of Bohemia. 200 years later, when faced with the danger of Adolf Hitler, the much more emancipated, I would assume much wealthier, in theory, much more influential Jewish communities of not only Europe, but America, were unable to really exert any significant pressure on Adolf Hitler. It's a great question. Why?
Right. So the question Vital examines in his book, and it obviously nags deeply at his soul, is what was it about basically 150 years of emancipation, integration, assimilation, et cetera, wider participation in European life that seems to have disabled the Jewish community or weakened its ability to act in its own defense? And so first you have to look at the mechanisms. In 1744, Jews had no political power. They couldn't run for office, on the continent at least. England was a different case. But on the continent of Europe, they didn't vote. Almost nobody voted. There weren't parliamentary democracies. Jews had no rights. They had privileges that could be revoked at any time. Maria Theresa's decree came suddenly and as a surprise. Whereas in the 20th century, there was plenty of forewarning of Hitler's intentions and program. I mean, it was public knowledge for at least 10 years before much was implemented. And some would argue that the Jewish communities of Europe had almost two decades in which to prepare and defend themselves and to respond to this growing threat that was first on the horizon and then came, unfortunately, tragically close to home. So in the intervening, in the 150 years between 1789 and 1939, there was the French Revolution. Jews gained citizenship, first in France and then in other countries in Europe. Ghetto walls were torn down. Jews could practice virtually any profession and often did. They could live anywhere in town. They were no longer confined to one neighborhood. They developed new forms of Judaism, Reform Judaism, Conservative Judaism, et cetera, et cetera. And as a community, they were much less unitary and much less unified. And then there was, later in the 19th century, the birth of the Zionist movement and all its sub-movements, all the subgroups of Zionism, which first convened as the World Zionist Congress in 1897, which was sort of an umbrella organization of lots of different fractious organizations that couldn't even agree on where a Jewish state should be, never mind whether there ought to be a Jewish state. And there were, of course, non-Zionists and anti-Zionists and labor Zionists. And I mean, on virtually every question, the Jews of Europe found themselves deeply divided. So in the course of this, let's say, century of liberation or emancipation, whatever you want to call it, between 1789 and the end of the 19th century, the whole nature of European Jewry changed quite radically. And then the question still remains, and I guess we'll get to this next week, why in the early 20th century could the Jews not unite to combat effectively an obvious mortal threat to their continued existence in Europe?
Great question, and we will continue to explore it next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. A priest and a rabbi are sitting next to each other on an airplane. After a while, the priest turns to the rabbi and asks, "Is it still a requirement of your faith to not eat pork?" And the rabbi responds, "Yes, that's still one of our beliefs." The priest asks, "Have you ever eaten pork?" The rabbi replies, "Yes, on one occasion I did succumb to temptation, and I tasted a ham sandwich." The priest nods in understanding and goes on reading. A while later, the rabbi turns to the priest and asks, "Father, is it still a requirement of your church that you remain celibate?" And the priest replies, "Yeah, that's still very much a part of our faith." The rabbi asks him, "Father, have you ever fallen to the temptations of the flesh?" And the priest replies, "Yes, Rabbi, on one occasion I was weak and broke with my faith." The rabbi nods understandingly. He's silent for a while, and then he says, "Beats a ham sandwich, doesn't it?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. In addition to the remarkable Ten Commandments reading that we have on the holiday of Shavuot, this week we chant the second portion of the Book of Numbers, Naso, on Shabbat. Naso includes a remarkable blessing. The Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessing, is really three distinct brachot, three separate prayers with which the ancient priests were commanded to bless the people. From its inception, this three-part blessing has had exceptional importance. The Torah quotes God as saying, "With this blessing you will place my name on the people of Israel, v'samu et shemi." That is, this very blessing conveys God's presence among us and offers God's protection. The blessing was given by the Kohanim, the highest class of priests, those entrusted with the service of the tabernacle and temple. We still use it at every joyous life cycle event. It remains powerful. The text is, "May God bless you and guard you. May the light of God's presence shine on you and be gracious to you. May God's presence turn to you and grant you peace." In essence, the Birkat Kohanim asks God to supply our most important needs. The majority of the interpretations of this portion see the first blessing as a request for physical safety and health, the second asking for material needs to be satisfied, and the third seeking spiritual comfort and confidence. Without any one of these blessings, our lives become a challenge. With all three, we are assured of true quality of life. After thousands of years, those three elements, safety, grace, and peace, remain central to our lives. They are all gifts from God. May you be blessed with each of these, with all of these, this week and always. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, filmmaker Marian Marzinski, explains how he came to make the incredibly moving new film, Never Forget to Lie, about child survivors of the Holocaust going back to the Warsaw Ghetto. Find out when we come back on Two Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel sought to avoid a direct confrontation with the Syrian regime last week by stressing that airstrikes across its northern border that it launched were intended to prevent weapons from reaching Hezbollah in Lebanon, rather than to destabilize the government of President Bashar al-Assad of Syria any further. Amid a cautious consensus that the bombing raids are unlikely to provoke an immediate response from Syria or its allies Hezbollah and Iran, Tzachi Hanegbi, an Israeli politician close to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, said the action was against Hezbollah, not against the Syrian regime. The Israeli airstrikes targeted stocks of Iranian-supplied Fateh 110 missiles, which have a 200-mile range and precision guidance systems held near Damascus. They followed unambiguous warnings that Israel would act to prevent sophisticated weapons reaching Hezbollah or jihadist fighters inside Syria. Israel, following its policy, has made no comments on the bombings. However, on Israel Radio, Tzachi Hanegbi said the aim of military action would be to keep advanced weapons from Hezbollah as soon as intentions are exposed, and also refrain from tension with Syria. The IDF Northern Commander, Major General Yair Golan, said there were no winds of war along Israel's borders with Syria and Lebanon, although the military was ready and alert to deal with any retaliation. Israel's northern airspace was closed to commercial traffic for a day following the airstrikes. Earlier, two of Israel's five Iron Dome batteries, a key part of its missile defense system, were moved to the north to be positioned near the cities of Haifa and Tzfat. Some analysts warn that any retaliation is likely to be against Israeli targets abroad, not a direct attack. The Syrians and their allies can now swallow their pride and do nothing, or decide they're fed up and launch an all-out clash with Israel. Both of these options are less likely than the third to raise the bar in the secret war, expressed in acts of terror in attacking Israeli interests in the world, firing from the Syrian part of the Golan Heights or the Lebanese border, said defense analyst Alex Fishman. Despite a bellicose response from the Syrian government and its allies, including a statement from Syria's deputy foreign minister Faisal al-Mikdad that Israeli airstrikes were a declaration of war, well, actually, they've been in war all along, technically, but never mind. Attention and resources are invested in clinging to power in Syria after 2 years of a bitter and costly civil war. They really don't want any part of fighting Israel. Former Mossad director Dani Yotom said Assad most likely won't respond at this time. The Syrian army and regime, which are almost completely preoccupied with survival, have no interest in opening a new front against Syria. On the other hand, it could very well be that Hezbollah or Iran will carry out a secret operation and try to commit terror attacks against an Israeli or Jewish target somewhere in the world. The U.S. gave Israel wholehearted backing for the weekend bombings in Syria, but was not given prior warning of Israel's actions. As President Obama said, the Israelis justifiably have to guard against the transfer of advanced weaponry to terrorist organizations like Hezbollah. We coordinate closely with the Israelis, recognizing that they are very close to Syria, very close to Lebanon. Reports of casualties from the airstrikes varied from fewer than 20 to several hundred. The tepid military response by Syria has included mortar shells fired from Syria landing in the Golan Heights in Israel on a couple of days last week. No damage or injuries were reported. Israel filed complaints over the mortar fire with a UN disengagement observer force. The mortars were fired erroneously as a byproduct of internal conflict in Syria, the IDF said in a tweet. In other news, outside of Syria, the most famous scientist in the world, British astrophysicist Stephen Hawking, canceled attending the Israeli presidential conference hosted by President Shimon Peres next month, and the organizers called it outrageous and improper. The first word on Hawking's cancellation was that he was withdrawing in support of the academic boycott of Israel, leading to this response. The so-called academic boycott against Israel is, in our view, outrageous and improper, certainly for someone for whom the spirit of liberty lies at the basis of his human and academic mission. Israel is a democracy in which all individuals are free to express their opinions, whatever they may be. The imposition of a boycott is incompatible with open democratic dialogue, said Israel Maimon, chairman of the Israeli presidential conference facing tomorrow, 2013. But it turns out there's more than a little intrigue surrounding this withdrawal, and that perhaps the scoop that the British newspaper The Guardian ran stating that Hawking was now supporting the boycott was not entirely correct. The Guardian had reported that Hawking told Peres in a letter that he would not participate in the June conference because he was supporting the boycott. Hawking did not announce that decision publicly, but the newspaper reported that a statement was published with the scientist's approval by the British Committee for the Universities of Palestine, which said it was Hawking's independent decision to respect the boycott based upon his knowledge of Palestine and on the unanimous advice of his own academic contacts there. After his participation in the event was confirmed in early April, Hawking was bombarded with messages to change his mind by boycott organizers and supporters, according to The Guardian. Hawking, head of the Practical Mathematics and Physics Department at Cambridge, last visited Israel in 2006 at the invitation of the British Embassy. He visited Israel three times prior to that as well, but apparently not this time. However, Cambridge published the email that was sent to Israel, which stated simply that Hawking was withdrawing purely for health reasons. Now The Guardian is trying to withdraw its story. Apparently, Hawking, who is 71 years old and functions in spite of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, in a wheelchair with a talking apparatus, was advised by his doctors not to fly. But then another reversal, it's not such a brief history of time this time, said that Hawking is now indeed supporting the academic boycott of Israel, and the presidential conference is saying it will no longer talk about it. I suppose nobody really knows what's going on here except Stephen Hawking. The presidential conference, in its fifth year, gathers world leaders and intellectuals for public discussions on a variety of subjects. Some 5,000 people from around the world, including executives of major global technology companies, academics, Nobel laureates, artists, past and present heads of state, have confirmed their attendance this year, even without Stephen Hawking. In yet more disturbing news, a new production of Richard Wagner's Tannhauser opera in Dusseldorf has drawn criticism for staging Nazi atrocities. At performances last weekend by the Deutsche Oper am Rhein company at the Dusseldorf Opera House, the audience reacted negatively to scenes featuring the gassing of concentration camp prisoners and the banned Hitler salute and swastika armband on stage. In one scene, a mother, father, and daughter are led up by members of the Wehrmacht. Their clothes are removed, they are shaved and shot. There reportedly is no music accompanying the scene. Burkhard Kosminski, the opera company's director, added the scenes that have drawn criticism. The opera company is apparently considering modifications. Israel's ambassador to Germany, meanwhile, reportedly has voiced displeasure. Oded Horowitz, head of the Jewish community of North Rhine, said in the Rheinische Post newspaper that survivors are likely to find the provocative handling of Nazi history in this Tannhauser production quite painful. While remembrance of Nazi crimes is important, he said, a theater scandal is not our preferred form of confronting the past. Many eschew Wagner's music because of the admiration that Hitler held for Wagner, as well as the composer's vicious anti-Semitism. Opera is no stranger to Nazi-oriented controversy. Just last July, Russian opera singer Evgeny Nikitin was pressured to withdraw from Germany's famous Bayreuth Opera Festival because of his Nazi tattoos on his chest and arm. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our fascinating guest this morning. He is documentary filmmaker Marian Marzinski. He's made several very powerful films about the Holocaust, about his own life, and other things. His new film is called Never Forget to Lie, about child survivors of the Holocaust ghetto who returned, some of them for the very first time, to see the site of their wartime experience. Marianne, we were talking earlier this morning about the powerful experience of actually going back for the first time, as opposed to sitting in your apartment, sitting in your house, talking about what it was like so many years ago. You yourself came out of that environment. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, my case is a little bit different, although truly I didn't go to the Warsaw Ghetto ever, even when I lived in Poland after the war, because simply it was traumatic and there was almost nothing there. I visited Poland before. It is a question, and some of the people that are in the film, except one couple, did visit Poland before. So it's not always going for the first time. It's going for the first time to a completely different level of emotional experience, going much deeper, going really to childhood. And this is what's happening now with the Holocaust, that we are the last eyewitness. And we were 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. We didn't have a voice for many, many years. First of all, we couldn't upstage our parents. Our parents, who had much concrete knowledge and memory, most of them are not around, wanted to protect us from coming to this, because it is almost a memory that theoretically can be erased by yourself. And many of us, not me, because I was making films about it, but many of us try to not to remember, simply, because we don't want our people around us to pity us. We had careers, etc. It was just too difficult. Now we have no choice, because the world wants to know and ask us. Now, what do we have to offer if we... Some of us trying to offer too much. Some of us trying to be historian, trying to tell the story that we heard from the parents or we read, etc. Because we are the only one left. In my film, I decided I don't want that. It maybe works at a school situation, but on film, it will be just redundant. It will be just redoing the story of the older generation. The unique things about us are those scattered memories of a child, a story of a trauma of a child, and can we relive being a child, especially in the front of the camera? Half of the people that I filmed were able to do it, half were not able to do it, for the emotional reason simply, or because you it's very hard to recall a moment, because you become the child then, and then you reduce yourself to a child, and your adult control does not allow you to do this, so you have a tendency to be a commentator on your childhood. And that's the story when people say, when I was a child, which means that I'm an adult, the child stand next to me, I'm talking about that child. In my film, you probably notice, we are the children.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
I just got to something that, in my opinion, was not really seen before on films on that subject.
There's one moment in particular, many really powerful moments, but when a woman looks up at these buildings, they're just buildings, right? And she gasps, and you can just sort of say, oh, that's where this happened, and the woman called me, and, you know, it just, the power is, it's very fresh. She's, again, 4 years older, 6 years old, whatever she was.
Right. Well, that's exactly the result of this approach, that I was with them, I comforted them, but I brought them to the unexpected places. And when you go to the unexpected places and it affects you, then then you really have a performance that you would never have outside that place. My problem was that when I was on the front of the camera, I don't have the guardian angel. You know, I was talking to a cameraman, and that was especially more painful to me for them, because I was kind of helping them.
Do you think you could have gotten these results on camera if you yourself did not have this background?
No, because I could not, as a film director and being a survivor by myself, I was able to tell them, hey guys, I know that you can tell me everything about Holocaust and the ghetto, about your uncle and your aunt and your family and who perished and how. I don't want that. I don't want 95% of the thing that is hearsay, that is something that you learn. I just want this little thing, which is your memory. I think if I were not one of them, they would be not very sensitive to tell them, don't tell me about your uncle,
yes,
don't tell me about your cousin, etc. But I knew what I wanted. I knew, and you notice, especially the woman that is talking about being on a gunpoint, she actually probably recalled the event that maybe took 30 seconds in about a minute and a half or something. This ability to go into feelings of something that really has happened brings to the Holocaust a dimension that is bigger than historical and bigger than the question of tragedy. It has become now a universal identification with people that have no even knowledge about Holocaust, and that will happen to learn about Holocaust by learning about the child trauma. This could happen in other circumstances, and is very well known to all of us, being orphaned, being child, being abandoned, etc. And I think that that's the way that we can bring today the Holocaust story to the new generation, for whom World War II is an old word. And the whole subject is getting old, obviously. How to bring the essence of it into young people so they can carry this to the future, especially non-Jewish?
I have a technical question. As a filmmaker, you need to be objective. You have professional requirements. How emotionally involved do you get? How do you keep yourself from, you know, these are very close to home. You're doing, particularly this film, so
very
close to your
much. And you actually put on the money that this is the conflict between a director that has to be cool and organized and who suddenly become a subject. So when I was filming the other people, it was certainly emotionally draining to me, but I tried to not to be in the places and in the time, because I had to think about the takes and placement of cameras, etc. So this balance allowed me to work. It was hard, but I was handling it. When I was facing the camera, there were cases that I would become incoherent in my speech. I would not make sense at one point because the emotion it's happened when I was visiting the place my father was killed. And now when the emotion takes over, you lose the entire control. So of course you have editing and then you eliminate certain things. But I would not make something like that another time. That's it. You know, that was the most difficult film for me to make, and that's my legacy for my children and for all other youngsters. Because really, who are we speaking today to the next generation?
When you note, as you do, that you know this is the last generation who will be the eyewitnesses. And we've been seeing this coming for a long time, but now, you know, the people who can testify are really, as you said, just the child survivors. What do you hope your legacy is?
Well, that's my legacy. Actually, I have already a little example how my legacy actually works. There is an amazing event in Italy. Every 2 years, 700 high school students go in 25 railroad cars, German railroad cars, in the middle of January. Following the last transport of the Italian Jews to Auschwitz, they go to Auschwitz. And the last time they went, I was invited as a child survivor. I show them the film in Krakow. They were all non-Jews, obviously. And their reaction was actually unbelievable. They said, only now we can humanize, you can see the Holocaust. We can touch you. You are not one of those who were killed, but you are the closest thing to the because you could have been killed. And seeing your story and touching you, we now are with you. We experience Holocaust. So actually, we are not in a bad situation, because in the last years, Holocaust were kind of overdoing. The vast majority of the people that watched Holocaust film was Jewish. There's no doubt about it. I don't know the numbers, but even I heard that Schindler's List was 95% seen in America by Jews, which is a huge audience which can make a box office. Now I think that we have to go to non-Jews and we have to connect to the different historic background, where World War II become an old war, but the other genocides that happen in the world, that should be our message to prevent them in the future, are known by the people, and we have to present this story with less historic baggage. Because as children, actually, we didn't know who Adolf Hitler was. Our Holocaust was that we became orphaned, that we'll be taken out of the family. And this is the association, I think, that will work. So I told them, I put this legacy in the hand of my own children. But, of course, they are biased. They have emotional attitude. But now I'm putting this in the hand of a non-Jews. And the reaction was phenomenal, and there was a governor of Tuscany that said, to them. We know why we're doing, because when the economic crisis comes, when people look for the scapegoat, when people start to become nationalistic and then somebody shot a black man in Florence several months ago, was unheard before. When this all starts, in the future, theoretically, it can be a Holocaust. That's what we're doing, especially being a country which a legacy of Mussolini and fascism. And I think that's clicked. So I think that I have a way of placing the legacy.
I want to thank filmmaker Marian Marzinski for a great visit here on Too Jewish. His film is called Never Forget to Lie. It's out on Frontline on PBS. Check the Frontline website, check your local PBS stations, but don't miss it. It's really a fantastic film. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Rabbi Richard Address, speaking on sacred aging, growing old Jewishly in the 21st century. Our playout this morning comes for the holiday of Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks and First Fruits, and the time of receiving the Ten Commandments, coming this Tuesday night with an all-night study session, the Tikkun Leil Shavuot, and Wednesday as well. This is a, frankly, ridiculous parody called Up All Night by a group called Rebbetzin Tap. You just kind of have to hear it. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, a good holiday of Shavuot, a Chag Sameach, and a week, we pray, of peace.
The 6th of Sivan, it's the day that we receive on.
Anything you want to learn, it's all right.
Put some water in the urn.
Stay up all night.
Put on your fedora. Time for Kabbalah Satorah.
Anything you want to learn.